session of February 2nd, 1977. From next week, February 9th, we'll meet in room 8. Room 8. Not much bigger. More comfortable. Next Wednesday, room 8. I had announced about the idiorhythmic novel. This novel by Simon Jacquemart, the volcano eruption of Krakatoa, this is the name of the volcano, Krakatoa. The subtitle is Unknown Rooms in a House. About Robinson Crusoe and the first language. I mentioned the U that he uses. It's a vast file. It's also a futile problem. We'll see where this fits in with all the myths of the origins of language. I didn't try to tackle the whole issue. It's too huge. Another remark about the monks on Mount Athos. I made a mistake. I said that in 1912 there were 7,000 monks. In 1972, 1,500 monks. But I've been told that there has been a recent revival. There are now 300 new monks transferred from other monasteries. There is a spiritual revival, especially in the Cenobia. It goes without saying that what is resisted, neglected, rejected, marginalized is idiorhythmy. Last time I stopped when I was giving a brief account of how idiorhythmy functioned on Mount Athos. We have to give a certain history from 963 to the present day. There has been a constant vacillation between the cenobitic structure and the idiorhythmic structure. As we'll see, at times this structure is very ascetic, at other times lenient, at times very poor, at times you have wealthy, comfortable monks. At times they are hardworking, at times idle. This can always be connected to a mystical experience, but in ethical terms, this is clearly an unclassifiable phenomenon. Now, a few words again on Mount Athos. It's through the way of life that we can reach the main problem. We have the small idiorhythmic structures in Dai-Aita. the principle, each monk is free to live at their own particular rhythm. For the labor, it's unequal. Some are very idle, some work a lot. The intellectual level, they receive more teaching than Cenobites. It's a sort of throwback, we can think, to the philosophical schools of ancient Greece. As to the constraints of life, we have no liturgical constraint in idiorhythmy. It's very light. The younger ones have to give some prayers. Once a year, all idiorhythmics engage in a communal act. They eat a big meal together. It's a very ancient anachoretic custom that seems to predate Christianity. Before Christianity, you had other communities, the Therapeutes, the Essenians, and they all had this communal meal. To conclude, we have a flexible conception of constraint, no rules, merely suggestions. There's a lot of mobility. This is the problem we meet with every community. It's the problem of ownership. We find here the same alternation, the same ambiguity, the same reversal, the same irrelevance. Despite ownership being of the utmost relevance to how lives are structured. It doesn't look so relevant. Originally, idiorhythmy is a sort of eremitism or a semi-anachoritism that entails total poverty. The Egyptian anachorites, after Saint Anthony, would be small artisans. They would weave wickerwork objects just enough to buy bread. On Mount Athos, at the end of the 14th century, there was a relaxation of the rules. Idiorhythmy led to leniency, to tolerance of certain practices. Cenobites were allowed to work on a piece of land to keep the revenues for themselves. They were living in a marginal version of community or land ownership. Then there was a new reversal. To alleviate the community's expenses, monks were allowed to manage and live within their own individual means, whether their own earnings or financial support received from a wealthier monk or based on their work. Whence, two categories of idiorhythmic. First, the wealthy, those who have a private income. Secondly, those who have no revenue of their own, the paramikri. They are often employed by the rich. It's a very supple structure that reproduces the social divide outside between the rich and the poor. This leniency around questions of ownership is clearly a sensitive issue for all forms of monarchism. This underscores the doctrinal marginality of idiorhythmy. In idiorhythmy, there is a certain indifference to money. It's an indifference to the law of anti-money or to the superego of poverty. Among the three great epistemes of modernity, we have Marx, Freud, the Christians, and we have an attack against money. Money is thought to be evil. It's a philosophy of indifference to money, and that is extremely rare. The last point I want to examine is that of power. What characterizes all the shapes taken by idiorhythmy especially from the solitary hermits to the communities of laureates is that they are always outside the control, outside a superior's control. There is no superior who gives orders. It's not the way of life that distinguishes idiorhythmy from cenobitism. Rather, the true dividing line is the degree to which they are dependent upon a power like that of the abbot. Cenobitism is more on the side of power. In the rare Western idiorhythmic structures, there is a little more power. But in the Oriental forms, no power. In the very first structures, there was a polarizer, like an elder. He was an elder, an example to follow, not a chief. In European structures, we have the cenobium, in which there's a monarchic power. This is different in pure idiorhythmic structures. There was a collegiate power. The idiorhythmics are in an assembly with a college of 6 members, and they are renewed through cooptation or in the event of the death of one of them, like the solitaire of Port-Royal or Buddhist monks. For practical tasks, they delegate managers for 1 year, called epitropes. To conclude on Athos, the only stable principle is the negative relationship to power. Once again, what we're dealing with is a consubstantial relationship between power and rhythm. Before anything else, the first thing that power imposes is a rhythm. It imposes a rhythm to everything, a rhythm of life, of time, of thought, of speech. The demand for idiorhythmy is always made in opposition to power. Think back to the first example I gave, the mother and her child. She imposes her own walking pace. She generates a dysrhythmy. Once more, we can see the distinction between what I call rhythm and rhythmos. Idiorhythmy is a means of safeguarding rhythmos against rhythm. It is, in fact, a flexible, free, mobile rhythm. This transitory, fleeting form calls up what happens in music. We have the metronomical rhythm and rhythmos. The metronomical rhythm is regular, but rhythmos is more like swing. It's not a musical rhythm. Jazz made us understand this. The rhythmos is exactly what we have in swing in jazz. It's regular, but very supple as well. We might say that the category that opposes power most is music, if we define music as rhythmos and not as rhythm. Rhythmos is a rhythm that allows for approximation, for imperfection, for a supplement, a lack. This lack is given in the expression idios, like idiom. What doesn't fit the structure, it's particular. This is a communal rhythm. Idiorhythmos doesn't fit the structure. We may remember what Casals would say, very rightly, rhythm, he would say, in a paradoxical manner, rhythmos is delay. I find this beautiful. To produce music is to be able to delay. Or it can be a hurriedness. Only a subject as idios can delay rhythm, which is a way of bringing it about. Now, I will have two shorter entries. Autarky. I will just mark this as a trait in the magic mountain, to go back to it, hero Hans Castorp, at the beginning, pays a visit to his cousin Joachim. Hans Castorp doesn't think he needs to go to a sanatorium. He only intends to stay for a few days as a visitor, a tourist, but he will end up staying there for 7 years. Similarly, in the novel, the uncle who visits the sanatorium to just see how Hans is getting along, who is at once terrified, fascinated by illness, he finds himself lured into discovering that he too is ill and that he should remain there. The uncle escapes without warning. This shows that the group exerts a fascination over all those who visit it. This fascination happens without any speech, without words. What is it that fascinates in the small group, like the gang, the sanatorium? It's a state of autarkia, autarky. It's not the emptiness that draws us in, it's rather the fullness, or if you prefer, the intuition that there's a vertiginous vacuity to the plenitude of the group. It's a little colony that needs nothing else than the internal life of the group. The group is intra-dependent. A group is, by definition, something that suffices to itself. If there is a material autarky in a group, it creates a feeling of absolute existence. It's also something that we can see in Jules Verne's novel. The sea is described as a purely autarkic milieu. There is nothing that would be outside the sea. The sea defines the milieu of the Nautilus, the submarine. It doesn't need the land. It doesn't need men. The sea provides him with all he needs: clothes, food, lighting, heating, energy. It provides even cigars. Some algae can be smoked. A source of Nemo's pride is that there is no one other than himself. Nemo means no one. He is no one else but himself. The first hermits rarefied their basic requirements, like food, to such an extent that they inclined towards autarky. There was a minimal exchange, like mats for bread. Incidentally, it was because of the risk of pride that Eremitism was stamped out. One saw a very great danger in it. At the same time, this kind of autarky created a fascination and attraction. We see this in the Magic Mountain. The sanatorium is this wholly autarkic milieu, which includes the intradependence of all affects. I can recall a personal situation. When I was a student, I was in a sanatorium. I was there during the years of the occupation. The sanatorium was in total isolation from the enormous problems of France. There were a few incidents about food, but apart from that, the sanatorium lived in total autarky, in total abstraction from the world. In the sanatorium, there was again this intradependence of affects. Because of this total cohabitation, you would find all the affects you wanted, you just had to choose. No need of the outside world. Once the structure of living together is established, it's everlasting. It's the same in the Magic Mountain. The hero can spend his entire life in the sanatorium. He doesn't even want to leave it. It will take the war of 1914 to interrupt this for Hans. For the visitor, the spectacle of the autarky of the group is fascinating, but there's repulsion and attraction. There's a fascination for death, but in reality, what is fascinating here is that it is never ending. That's a fascination for this eternity. It represents an eternal space, a perpetuity, which is produced by the structure of autarky. This is about autarky. Now, another entry. The title is Banc, Bench.
La vision d'un vivre ensemble qui sont
I would mention the vision of a living together that would effect the perfectly smooth symbiosis of what are nevertheless separate individual beings. I'm referring to a school of fish, banc in French. So I looked up in a dictionary in the Encyclopedia Universalis a school of fish. I quote, a coherent, massive, uniform grouping, subjects of the same size, the same color, normally of the same sex, all moving in the same direction in a synchronized fashion. There should be some methodological caution. One should never do what I'm doing. That is, one should never compare traits of animal ethology with traits of human sociology. One should never infer one order from the other. Between the two, there's always at least this separating them language. Between the animal and the human order. There is an attempt today to see a common ground between humans and animals. There are parallels. For instance, between groups like the axis of intelligence, a more successful order, the aptitude for living together is more successful, it seems, for certain orders. We have this in societies of insects and in human societies we have also a certain aptitude for living together. We can say that those two series have the same hierarchy, but there is something that is not comparable. In an insect society, the living together is based on innate behavior. In the societies of man, there is the intelligence of man that is individual and not specific. And the structure of living together is learned. It's what we call culture. Imagine a sort of world cataclysm, a world catastrophe, in a world of bees, in which there would only be a queen bee. In a few weeks, they will be able to reproduce themselves. It will be functional after a few weeks, just as before. The structure of bee society allows for this rapid reduplication. Imagine the same catastrophe for man, as you see in many science fiction novels or films. You wouldn't have such a rapid replication. The little babies would have to relearn everything. It would take again thousands of years. It would take a long time. The order of ethology of the animal order is a dangerous image. It can supply fictions, images, not really an explanation. So what I'm introducing here with the school of fish is unlike the usual vision that's so banal, which is of society compared to an anthill. We often hear this, that humanity runs the risk of a universalized bureaucracy and that society becomes like an anthill. What is feared here is the bureaucratic training. One has to note that the mass culture of capitalist societies had nothing to do with specific regimes. It's a rhythm of a vulgar society. Mass culture produces something like an anthill society. Television looks like an extension of the anthill idea. But this is not the case with the school. There is a collective, synchronized, abrupt shift in tastes, in pleasures, in fashions, in fears. The school of fish offers a more terrifying image than that of the anthill. In the anthill, the equalization of the individuals, the mechanization of social functions, destroys annulled subjects. With the school, the cancelling of subjects, the training of affects, leads to a structure in which everything is wholly equalized. How can politics preserve the subject? Indeed, in the school, you'll see why I mentioned this. I haven't finished my description. I have to add the way in which schools of fish, like herring, make love. What happens during the spawning season? You will have a school of male fish that will swim above a school of females. As the females will release their eggs, which ensures the reproduction of species without any contact. It's a pure species without subjects. the mass of eggs floats up to the surface and passes through the school of males, and then they release their sperm. We can see this with herrings. Bodies are pressed against each other, and yet they don't make love. Hence this idea that the more idiorhythmy is foreclosed, the more eros is excluded. The more idiorhythmy is foreclosed, the more eros disappears. Idiorhythmy, we can say, is a constitutive dimension of eros. There is a proportional, direct relationship between the particular rhythms, the aerations, the distances, the differences of living together, and the plenitude, the richness of eros. I'm going too fast here, but I would like to suggest an erotics of distance. In this erotic of distance, we would have something that we find in Taoism. About idiorhythmy, it protects the body in that it keeps it at a distance in order to safeguard its value, its desire. This is all about the school. And now, more historical considerations. At times, pure fantasies, at times, information. We'll talk about béguinage. The béguinage were béguine, a specific kind of nun, would gather. These problems concern us . The béguinage is the Occidental attempt to create an idiorhythmic space within Catholicism that, generally speaking, has been hostile to idiorhythmy and has favored purely cenobitic monachism. We'll see that it differs in various ways from the Oriental Athonite idiorhythmy. A little something about history. The phase of expansion of the béguinage was in the 13th and 14th century. In the normative and normal sense of the term, as we shall see, to begin with, it had a suspect, heretic, marginal inflection. It became a more normalized institution. These were religious organizations in cities. These were people dedicated to living a religious life who withdrew from ordinary society, mostly women, but at the beginning there were begini, B-E-G-H-I-N-I, who were men. In the 13th and 14th century, these institutions flourished in Holland, but also in France, in Germany, in Spain. In the 15th century, the institution died out in Holland, partially in France, the last beguinage were more or less eradicated at the time of the French Revolution. But then their numbers would increase in Belgium with a more severe, strict disciplinary regime. Today, it's only in Belgium you have 12 convents, 12 beguinages. In Ghent, you have the Grand Convent with 400 beguines in Belgium. Just a word about space. The space of living together. This is the same principle as Mount Athos, the lore, to oppose to the phalansteries, the monasteries, and the communities. Idiorhythmic space means small houses, hermitages inhabited by two or three people, called the curtis. They were built in the precincts of a church, near a hospital, and they needed running water. In some cities, you would have the beguinal quarter. That was a separate parish. It was enclosed in high walls. Its doors were kept open in the daytime, often had its own cemetery. The way of life. The structuring principle is that life is situated between religious life and secular life, but the rules are stricter than in Oriental idiorhythmy. There was really a rule. You have the three key principles of the cenobitic institution. First, stability. They were obliged to live there. Residency. You could not leave the place. Secondly, chastity. Not necessarily for life. There was no vow of chastity, but for the duration of the stay. The beguine were called the continentes, which was, as you know, one of the main features of the Albigeois. Finally, the main difference is total obedience to a superior, called magistrate, martyr, and then above those superiors, there was a mother superior, who was a grand dame. She had a special costume, whereas all the others had a poor woman's clothes, a black robe, and white headdress. There were occasional visits. There was a secular inflection. No religious vows. Visits were allowed. They could go out. There was nevertheless a timing if there were no canonical hours. In some, it was a quasi-monastic life, with austere rules, the idiorhythmy is only in the timing, which is fairly flexible, and the fact that they had permission to go outside. It's a very rigid idiorhythmy, strongly inflected by law, a paradoxical idiorhythmy, paradoxical according to our criteria, since it's trying to operate under the command of a power. Two conditions, historic, were allowed to people the beginning. First, the Crusades that eliminated all the husbands produced a sharp increase in the number of widows, a surplus of women. Some were wealthy ladies who chose to withdraw from society. They decided to live together, often seeking the protection of a group to disadvantage individuals. The second element is the precarious situation of urban working classes. In the Middle Ages, they sought shelter within the precincts of a monastery. It was an organism of protection, a protective organization. So you would find both rich women with a source of income and poor women. The richest women were there with the poorer women who lived off benefactors' donations. Begging was prohibited. It's a little like what you get with university grants in bourgeois regimes. You cannot beg. Poor women would become servants. They would be employed by a beguine. Or they could work. Manual labor was allowed. They specialized in washing, bleaching, lacework production was due to the beguinage. Finally, there's always the same problem, power. A tension between power and marginality. The origin of the beguini in the masculine, in the plural, is obscure. The word has several etymologies. It seems that at the beginning of the 12th century, beguini was a name given to Albigensis in Cologne. At the beginning, it was an insult. It meant heretic. The beguin or beggar share a number of features with the Albigensians. They have a horror of vows, the love abstinence, they do the public beating of the breast. And also, it was forbidden to sleep without a nightshirt on. You couldn't sleep naked. This is a key clause in religious rules. A warning to those of you who don't wear pajamas in bed. Quite a number nowadays. Then the feminine form of Begins. That's why they were called the Continentes, the chaste women. One should remember that, historically speaking, chastity was the first Christian vow, next to the other vows, like obedience or poverty. They came later. The vow of chastity was central. It was there in the first churches. The function of the first churches at the time of the apostles was to produce virgins. The Begin were these Continentes, with a link with these heretics Albigeois. These ill-favored heretical origins were soon forgotten. They were normalized. The church, in a way, managed to recapture all this, recuperate these marginal organizations. They added a priest to all those communities, and the superior, and then the power of the church would entail that there would be a rule. They wanted to avoid any suspicion of heresy by doing this. They had to follow the rule of Saint Augustine, which is a rule for semi-religious men and women. You see the differences with respect to Oriental idiorhythmy. Whether it is Antonite or Athenite, here there is the stamp of Roman legalism, Catholic and Roman. First, austerity, the weight of the rule, of the law. Secondly, hierarchy and control. Third, maybe all the beguinage were more focused on charity, helping others in society, than on mysticism. In the beguinage, you see a very domesticated form of idiorhythmy. Next Wednesday, room 8. We'll talk about bureaucracy. We will have, unhappily, to return to room 10 until the end of the class.